Hi, Dave Emery here. This is Side 1 of For the Record program number 791. They may not know art, but they know what they like. This is being recorded on May 4th of the year 2014. In this program, we are going to correlate events from the past, surprise, surprise, the World War II period, and recent events in the world today. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at a recent book called Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, authored by Simon Dunstan, D-U-N-S-T-A-N, and Gerard Williams, last name W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S. This book is meticulously researched and very well documented. Parts of it are clearly specified by the authors as being informed speculation, or as they put it, if they were hunters, they can track their prey from the telltale signs, even when the prey is not in immediate view. What they maintain, the book is about what was termed Aktion Feuerland, or Operation Fireland. That was the German name for Tierra del Fuego, or Patagonia. It is an area primarily in Argentina, but also in southern Chile, that has a lot of volcanic activity, hence the Spanish name, or the Argentine Spanish name, Tierra del Fuego, or Land of Fire. As the authors point out, it has an area that 1.5 times the size of Texas, is very sparsely populated, or was at the time, and to an extent still is, and much of the population at that time was not only of German extraction, but very sympathetic to the Third Reich. What the authors did was to begin investigating what they are very frank about saying they thought was simply a conspiracy theory that they were going to investigate. And they wound up not only convinced that the theory was basically true, but they set it in a larger political and historical context. Although Hitler's escape, and there is a great deal of very meticulous analysis and documentation, although Hitler's escape was sort of the centerpiece of Aktion Feuerland, it really falls into the larger context of the late World War II and post-war and Cold War maneuvering between the Third Reich and its post-war underground manifestations and the United States and the West. The two principal figures in Aktion Feuerland, as posited by the authors, are two names very well known to regular listeners to the program and users of the website, Alan Dulles for the American side, officer for the OSS, the World War II Intelligence Service, and a precursor to the CIA, and on the Axis side, Martin Bormann, Hitler's chief deputy, and the real power behind the throne of the Third Reich. What the authors maintained happened was that a Faustian deal was worked out between Dulles and Bormann, in which the Allies would get the key Nazi military technology and also many of the top scientists, such as Wernher von Braun and the rocket scientists from Peenemünde at Nordhausen, who did the V-1 and V-2 rockets, and who became the epicenter of the American Space Agency, really the American space effort, I should say. There were key officials at NASA. Wernher von Braun, by the way, was an SS officer. And in addition, the West would also have access, or at least partial access, to the cream of Western artistic civilization. The Nazis had looted the most valuable artworks of Europe. Many of those artworks went into private collections. The creme de la creme, so to speak, of Western art was destined for the Führer Museum. That was Hitler's personal art museum in Linz, Austria. That's L-I-N-Z. That was Hitler's birthplace. He was himself a frustrated artist, and part of his revenge on the world was to have the world's greatest art museum in his hometown, featuring all of the top works of Western art, except those that were in his and Goebbels, and Hermann Goering's personal collections. Now, ultimately, of course, that museum was never built, but the artwork that was intended for that museum, and also the artwork that was held by Hitler personally, Goebbels and Goering and other top Nazi leaders, became one of the bargaining chips for this deal. I suspect that the deal actually went much further in the incorporation of the Galen spy organization into Western intelligence and the CIA, plus the simple reinstitution of Nazi elements, albeit without their uniforms, at every level of the German post-war government was another part of the deal. However, these authors only deal with primarily the weapons technology and Project Paperclip, and the artwork. Bormann, according to the authors, was quite content to blow up the top works of art which had been secreted in deep mines around Germany, primed with explosives, and in exchange for allowing not only Hitler's escape, but also Bormann's escape, those of Heinrich Müller and other top Nazis, those Western works of art were to be spared, and also the top weapons technology and technicians were to be transferred under Project Paperclip. Of course, Alan Dulles was a key sponsor of the Galen outfit, deeply involved in President Kennedy's assassination or the cover-up thereof. Also, had advised the Bush family on their Nazi underinvestments in Nazi Germany. Now, that is the past. What we're going to examine in terms of the present is the strange case of Cornelius Gurlitt, last name capital G-U-R-L-I-T-T, as in Thomas. He was a strange fellow who came to light in Munich in 2010. Turns out he had millions of dollars worth of artwork stashed in his, quote, dingy, unquote, apartment. Whenever you get one of these guys or gals who is the focal point of a state-slash-intelligence cover-up, as this appears to be, they're always portrayed as sort of a weirdo living in a, quote, dingy apartment, unquote. Well, this fellow, this weirdo, this lone nut, this occupant of a dingy apartment had the most valuable collection of looted Nazi art ever seen in one place under his control. It turns out that had come from his father, Hildebrand Gurlitt. The son was Cornelius, and Hildebrand Gurlitt had been a Nazi art dealer to Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels and other top Nazis, and had been recruiting or gathering looted Nazi art for the Führer Museum in Linz, Austria. This places the Gurlitt family at the very epicenter of the working hypothesis presented by authors Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams in their book, Gray Wolf. I'll tell you a little more about the book as we proceed. There are numerous links to the Amazon website at which one can purchase it. And I would invite, at the very beginning of the program, those who are skeptical, also those who are interested and titillated, to follow up and get the book. If it could be said that the proof of the pudding is in the eating, perhaps one could say that the proof of the writing is in the reading. So again, if this seems like utter BS, and the authors are very careful about stressing when they are engaging in very informed speculation and when they are dealing in recorded fact. And again, they began investigating what they considered to be a conspiracy theory and very clearly became convinced of the reality of that theory. And we're very disturbed by it. One of the points they make, too, is that Hitler personally was not really all that important to the deal itself. What was really central was Bormann's control over the Nazi Party apparatus during and after World War II, and his complete control of Adolf Hitler, who was the supreme leader, of course, of Nazi Germany, was central to Bormann's own control of the Nazi Party apparatus, again, during and after the war. Hitler himself, according to this book, we won't have time to go into it here, that's why I'm mentioning it, was more or less sidelined by the early 1950s, and according to the authors, died in February of 1962 in Argentina in a state of very poor mental and physical health. But by the early 1950s, Hitler had been completely sidelined and isolated and was himself nothing more than a political artifact, simply having been used in order. Bormann very carefully controlled Hitler's activities and the access of the other Nazi luminaries to Hitler, and in so doing, and also by mastering the very complex Nazi bureaucracy, Bormann was able to cement his own control over the Nazi Party apparatus. So in a sense, Hitler himself is something of a peripheral element. He's central to the drama at hand here, but himself was a subordinate actor. And again, by the time of his death in 1962, he was isolated and was simply nothing more than an inconvenient artifact. We're going to begin by taking a look at some excerpts of the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. This is published in hardcover by Sterling Books, and the copyright is by 2011 by Simon Dunstan, Gerard Williams, and interestingly enough, an organization called Spitfire Recovery Limited. No connection with SpitfireList.com. That is my website, with all of my life's work available for download for free. The book was published in 2011 in hardcover, and of the deal between Martin Bormann and Alan Dulles. Again, the code name for the operation was Aktion Feuerland, Feuerland being the German for Tierra del Fuego. The authors write, "To the end, Bormann was determined to save the looted wealth of Germany for his own nefarious ends and to sustain a select band of Nazis following military defeat and the fall of Berlin. Massive funds were channeled abroad, while large stashes of bullion and stolen artworks were hidden deep underground in mines across the Third Reich. These were primed with explosives for demolition, which Bormann considered preferable to allowing them to fall into the hands of the Bolshevik hordes. But to Bormann, the artworks were also a bargaining tool. It seems evident that Bormann offered the OSS, again, America's World War II intelligence service and the precursor of the CIA, a Faustian pact, the fruits of 1,000 years of Western art, together with the secrets of Nazi Germany's advanced military technology in exchange for the escape of one man, Adolf Hitler. The alternative was the total destruction of the jewels of Western civilization. This was the key to Aktion Feuerland. The deal was done, and on the night of April 28, 1945, the plan was put into place. The Grey Wolf was on the run." That was the code name for Adolf Hitler. By the way, the name Adolf Hitler, as the authors point out, is derived from the Middle Old German, or the Old High German. It means High Wolf. And by the way, the authors give a great deal of credence and cite abundantly the work Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, which is available for download for free in the anti-fascist books section of the Spitfire website. Now, the Faustian deal is described in greater length by the authors here, and in italics they put the parts of the deal that they where they are speculating, engaging in very informed speculation, and the parts that can be documented. The upshot is, and by the way, the negotiations between Bormann and Alan Dulles were an outgrowth, according to the authors, founded upon the well-documented negotiations between Alan Dulles and SS General Karl Wolf, Himmler's personal adjutant, to negotiate a separate surrender for the Nazi forces in Italy. This was called Operation Sunrise and is discussed at considerable length in For the Record program number 1978, in exchange for not only Western or Third Reich military technology and some of the key technicians such as Wernher von Braun and the Peenemünde V2 team. The Allies also got access to what was called the Uranium Club. Those were the German scientists working on a Nazi atomic bomb. Although they were far behind the Western effort, they still had considerable expertise. And beyond that, there was a lot of uranium ore, which the Nazis had, some of which they had refined. And the key part of the deal was making sure that that was given over to the Western Allies so it would not fall into Soviet hands. The Bormann team also agreed not to destroy the fruits of 1,000 years of Western artistic civilization. The stick, as described here, was a disinformation plan in which the Third Reich had been quite successful in convincing the Allies that they had developed the capabilities of attacking the U.S. East Coast with weapons of mass destruction. Now, we haven't got time to go into it here, but the authors go into the disinformation effort at great length. Basically, what the Reich had done, they had disseminated disinformation that there were U-boats that could launch V-1 rockets, basically prototype cruise missiles armed with nerve gas warheads, with sarin and tabun, T-A-B-U-N, two key deadly nerve gases that were developed by I.G. Farben. In fact, they had experimented with launching V-1s, but they did not have the U-boat technology. They did not have the U-boat fleet put together that could launch these. However, they had successfully convinced naval intelligence in the U.S. that they had them. And as the authors point out in a very detailed analysis, they had set up a picket of very advanced U-boats in the middle and southern Atlantic, and this had attracted the attention of Western intelligence because of the Bletchley Park Ultra Intercepts in the United Kingdom, and that a few of these U-boats, this created the diversion. In other words, it made their threat to bombard the U.S. with nerve gas-armed V-1 missiles launched from U-boats credible to Western naval intelligence. And then the authors maintain that some of these U-boats were then broken off, using that as an operational cover, and then transferred Hitler and other top Nazis to Patagonia as part of Aktion Feuerland. That's the essence of it. The authors write here on pages 133 and 134. In Bormann's characteristic style, the carrot and the stick, Ernst Kaltenbrunner and SS Lieutenant Colonel Hans Helmut von Hummel, H-U-M-M-E-L, indicated to Alan Dulles that Bormann was willing to provide to the Allies as an inducement or carrot information as to the whereabouts of all the Nazi looted art. It would be handed over intact together with the National Treasure of Germany, including its gold deposits, currency reserves, bearer bonds, and industrial patents, except, of course, for the substantial part of this treasure that Bormann had already secreted abroad. An additional and supremely attractive carrot was Bormann's undertaking to deliver to the Allies examples of the most modern weapons technology, together with the whereabouts of the designers such as Wernher von Braun and his V-2 team, and the nuclear scientists and the uranium ore of the Uranium Club. Furthermore, the ceasefire in Italy, parenthetically that was Operation Sunrise, would be ratified immediately. But what was the desired price for such treasures? A blind eye turned to the escape of Adolf Hitler, Eva Braun, Martin Bormann, Heinrich Gestapo Müller, Hermann Fegelein, and Ernst Kaltenbrunner. The rest of the Nazi hierarchy was to be abandoned to their fate. By the way, Fegelein was an SS general. He was Eva Braun's brother-in-law and himself experienced with anti-partisan warfare on the Eastern Front, which necessarily placed him in the middle of some very brutal activities. And Kaltenbrunner later doubled on the Bormann team, took a lot of the loot from the Third Reich's, from the Reichsbank, and tried to stash it for his own use, and he was then abandoned to his fate. He was executed at Nuremberg. And then the authors go on to write, the quote, stick, unquote, was simple. Germany now claimed to be capable of bombarding the eastern seaboard of the U.S. with weapons of mass destruction. Considerable effort had been invested in selling that disinformation to U.S. intelligence agencies with some success. See Chapter 16. Parenthetically, that is a chapter in which the U-boats Picket and Gambit was detailed at considerable length. Continuing, these weapons incorporated V-1 warheads armed with the most toxic nerve agents ever devised, sarin, S-A-R-I-N, and tabun, T-A-B-U-N. In addition, many repositories of the greatest works of art produced during centuries of Western civilization was now held hostage, and this threat was entirely credible following Hitler's Nero Decree of March 19th. Officially titled Demolitions on Reich Territory, this decree ordered the utter destruction of all German industrial infrastructure and technology. Although not included in the official order, it also implied the destruction of cultural assets and the elimination of any key personnel who might be useful to the Allied powers. One of the things the authors point out on page 242 is that even at this point in time, there are thousands of documents pertaining to Hitler's whereabouts in the post-war period that are still classified as top secret on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, of course, that raises and highlights the very obvious question of why would these documents still be top secret almost the better part of a century after the end of the war, concerning someone who supposedly was dead almost three-quarters of a century ago. Obviously that is a very obvious question. The authors write on page 242, during this period, the late 1940s, the FBI was taking reports of Hitler being in Latin America very seriously. Thousands of documents pertaining to Hitler from these years are still classified as top secret on both sides of the Atlantic. Nevertheless, and despite the very heavy censorship of the few files released into the public domain, some information can be gleaned. By the way, the authors cite copious eyewitness accounts of Hitler's post-war activities, and also they cite the writings of some well-known American journalists, including Walter Winchell and Drew Pearson, the New York Times writers, about the alleged escape of Adolf Hitler and the preparations for same. They also note that neither Stalin nor the top Soviet general of the time, Marshal George Zhukov, believed that Hitler had died, and that Eisenhower himself, General Dwight Eisenhower, later President Dwight Eisenhower, emphasized that there was no proof of Hitler's death. Stalin never believed Hitler was dead, insisting at the Potsdam Conference on July 17, 1945, that he had escaped, probably to Spain or Argentina, unquote. Stalin's top general, Marshal George Zhukov, said on August 6, 1945, we found no corpse that could be Hitler's, unquote. General Dwight D. Eisenhower stated publicly on October 12, 1945, quote, there is every assumption that Hitler is dead, but not a bit of conclusive proof that he is dead. He told the Associated Press that Russian friends, unquote, had informed him that they had been, quote, unable to unearth any tangible evidence of his death, unquote. One U.S. senator went as far as offering $1 million U.S. dollars for proof of Hitler's death. It has never been claimed. The authors, again, they put great credence in and repeatedly cite the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free from the SpitfireList.com website. And they note that the Union Banking Corporation of New York, which was used by the Bormann Organization to transfer funds to the was used by the Bormann Organization to transfer funds to the U.S. And I would note that at this particular point in time, that organization was managed by Prescott Bush Sr. and his father-in-law, George Herbert Walker. They were the grandfather and great-grandfather, respectively, of George Walker Bush, and the father and grandfather, respectively, of his father, George Herbert Walker Bush, also, of course, a president, and the man for whom CIA headquarters is named, and also the father of Jeb Bush, who figures to be the Republican nominee in 2016. On page 85 of the Union Banking Corporation and its role as a vehicle for Borman capital transfer to the U.S., the authors write as follows. With exquisite hypocrisy, Borman made use of the Thiessen family's private bank in Rotterdam, Bank for Handel und Scheepvaart NV, which had originally been founded by August Thiessen in 1918 in order to send illicit funds out of Kaiser's Germany as defeat in World War I approached. Money was channeled to the Union Banking Corporation of New York, which was wholly owned by Fritz Thiessen's Vereinigte Stahlwerke AG, or United Steelworks. From there, it was dispersed to accounts in other American banks, including National City Bank, Chase National Bank, and Irving Trust, and used to buy stocks in U.S. companies and corporations. And there are a number of interesting things that the authors go into about the nature of the Nazi capital transfer to Argentina, and that was the country to which Hitler ostensibly fled, according to their working hypothesis. Interestingly enough, one of the key people involved with the Borman capital program was none other than Eva Perón, the Evita of Broadway musical fame, formerly named Eva Duarte. And according to the authors, and they have lavish documentation, Eva Duarte was a Nazi spy during World War II and deeply involved with the Borman capital transfer. And according to Borman, far more intelligent than her husband, Juan Perón. On page 198, the authors write, Martin Borman, as always, was entirely clear-sighted, and during that year, he put in hand his plan to prepare and fund that refuge, Aktion Feuerland. The Nazi sympathizers in Argentina enjoyed a virtually free rein, continuing to operate schools with Nazi symbols and ideology, and meeting regularly, although by 1943, not as publicly as before. But the key conspirators were few, a group limited to people Borman had reason to trust. These included a clique of powerful, venal bankers and industrialists such as Ludwig Freude, a charismatic, ambitious army officer, Juan Domingo Perón, and a beautiful, intelligent actress, Eva Duarte. And later, of course, she became Evita Perón. Still more from page 210. Ludwig Freude's and Eva Duarte's involvement in the smuggling operation was made clear in an Argentine police document of April 18, 1945. This detailed the operations of Freude, agent of the Third Reich, and his dealings with an Argentine agent named Natalio. This informant wrote that Freude had made very substantial deposits in various Buenos Aires banks in the name of the well-known radio theatrical actress Maria Eva Duarte. Freude told Natalio that on February 7, 1945, a U-boat with the words Geheime Reichssache, or Reich Top Secret, stenciled on them, packages from a U-boat with the words Geheime Reichssache, or Reich Top Secret, stenciled on them, had been taken to a Lahusen ranch run by two Nazi brothers just outside Buenos Aires, unquote. Deposits of gold and various currencies were later made in Eva's name at the Banco Alemán Transatlántico, Banco Germanico, and Banco Tornquist. We'll resume with this thread of discussion on Side 2. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 791. They may not know art, but they know what they like. Recorded on May 4th of 2014, I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.